welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Islam and the Caliphate, the myths about it, which have helped create ISIS. It's Moeen Yassin from Global Vision 2000, the think tank. Also, James Tracy, speaking from Florida. He runs something called the Memory Hole blog, and he's lost his job as a professor for criticising the media coverage of the Sandy Hook attacks. He also compares them to Britain's Dunblane attacks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, or prsc.org.uk. And I'll give you proper contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Moeen Yassin. I'm speaking on behalf of Global Vision 2000, independent UK Islamic think tank. I'm in England, in Rochester, just now.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me, Moeen, and I'm not sure I'm not the only person to be fascinated by it, is this kind of what they call kind of fake Islam. We've seen it with the coup attempt in July in Turkey, accusations against something called the Gulen movement in the United States. Can you tell us a bit about that? Who is Gulen and what is the Gulen movement?
In modern, the contemporary Islamic world, and indeed Turkey, there are many Islamic movements, not just sects, you know, theological schools of thought, but movements which are populist, popular, and which have a very broad agenda, not just religious, could be humanitarian, could be social, could be political, and even economic.
But tell us about this. What about this Gulen movement specifically? Who is Gulen and what do they believe?
Well, the Gulen movement, as far as I know, is a Turkish Orthodox Islamic revivalist movement. They may have a focus on humanitarian, religious agendas. No doubt, I'm sure they have a political agenda too. Mm-hmm.
Now, people in Turkey, more than anywhere else pretty much, have been pointing the finger at this Gulen movement as being behind the coup attempt back in July, which was an abortive attempt. It didn't succeed. And it seems to have swung a lot of opinion of the rich and powerful in Turkey against the United States, because Gulen is where, or that's where this Gulen chap is. So what do you know about what their influence might have been and involvement in that coup?
Well, I mean, they are popular. They have a huge education empire, if you want to call it that, both in Turkey and in Turkic-speaking countries or Turkic kinship countries. What can one say, I mean, in this day and age, in the age of deceit? I mean, they're a good scapegoat, obviously, for various people to kick about.
What do they teach? What kind of things are they... if they've got all these schools, it's interesting to know what is their agenda.
Well, there, as I said, in contemporary... Well, Turkey, if we just focus on Turkey, has gone through a massive U-turn since Ataturk, who made it lean towards the West, ideologically, socially. And the Gulen movement, and indeed the AKP, you know, the Justice Party, are both manifestations of Turkey's revivalism to conservative Islam. Indeed, both of them are allies. There was a fallout, I understand, maybe bad blood. But to accuse the Gulenists of the coup d'etat, I don't think it does justice. Maybe they were used by another power, in this case, the Pax Americana, perhaps to destabilize. That's another issue. They may have been manipulated by other forces.
Okay, look, let's move on to Britain, because we have another sort of, I mean, they're not the same, but they're a similar sort of alternative Islamic think tank organisation that does a lot of education work called Ahmedia, A-H-M-E-D-I-A. What do you know about them?
Yes. Well, quite a lot. I mean, in contemporary Islam, I'll go back the last 200 years. There have arisen various, as I said, revivalist movements. The Ahmadiyya movement specifically grew up in British India, the Raj. And indeed, after the so-called mutiny that we call here, or revolt. So after 1857, notice what I said, after, in North India, the power centre of India and Pakistan, actually, more or less, Delhi, Islamabad area, in a town called Qadian, that's why they're called Qadianis, or Mirza Ghulam Ahmad. They have also the name Mirzai, Qadiani, Ahmadiyya. A guy rose up, a revivalist, in the British post-revolt mutiny era, and he claimed to be a messiah, the promised messiah of Islam, dare I say Christianity. So it's a mix. It's a, you know, a confusion or convoluted interpretation of Islam and Christianity, actually.
Now, that's a long time ago. So what is the... I mean, well, do they have a more modern so-called messiah? Because, I mean, these are, everyone's a little bit, I think, quite rightly questions anyone that comes along and says that I'm the messiah. I mean, and it starts to sound like it might be a kind of cult.
Well, Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam said in, as you know, we had a major conference or a specialist conference on eschatology, that in end times, Muslims will be divided into 73 groups. Now, this end time scenario is also relevant to other faiths, I believe, to really understand, you know, authentic Christianity, authentic Judaism, authentic Islam is a huge challenge in an age of deceit. But anyway, the bottom line is the Ahmadiyyas have obviously grown since the late 70s onwards. In Pakistan, there's several million of them. They're a huge issue. They're believed to be blasphemous. Why? Because not because they believe in a guy called Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, but because they're claiming to be Muslims. But according to the mainstream, all mainstream Muslim sects or theological schools of thought, they have attacked the basic tenet of Islam, which is the creed of Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, I testify that Muhammad is the prophet of God. By definition, it means the last prophet, by the way, of 124,000, from Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. So they've attacked that fundamental belief. And the second part of the creed is to testify that nothing should be worshipped except God in total sovereignty. So the first tenet of the faith has been attacked, and that's why in Pakistan or India, indeed, or the Indian subcontinent, there is a movement to, to emphasize the seal of prophethood, which they have, in a sense, attacked.
Now, that's very interesting that they've got these two things which seem to go against Islam, the Ahmadiyya sect. But, I mean, there is also talk, surely, of someone called the Mahdi in Islam, who is going to lead this great caliphate of some kind anyway. And surely, Muhammad can't be the final prophet if you've got the Mahdi coming in the future in order to lead Islam into the promised land.
No, the Mahdi means in Arabic, as an Arabist myself, I'm not Arabic, but I've studied Arabic and a specialist. Mahdi means the rightly guided one. He's a revivalist. A prophet is one who has had communication of some sort from divine source, maybe a book, revelation. A revivalist is a common man. It could be you, could be me, actually. There's a huge difference between a person who has been chosen as a vehicle to communicate divine commands, revelation to the people in a time-space context, compared to a Mahdi. But this comes back to the point that in end times, I believe modern civilization, global civilization, cannot be looked in isolation from the fact that we're in an era of time which is quite unique, actually. And in this time, deceit is rampant.
Well, I think you mentioned yourself, didn't you? And I think you're quite right, that there are these many proliferation of fake versions of Islam, fake versions of Judaism, and fake versions of Christianity.
Yes. Well, the latest news today is fakery is everywhere. Donald Trump is talking about fake news. I mean, what is reality, actually? What is news? You know, we're coming to a fundamental issue in contemporary global village. What is news and what isn't? And this is very relevant to the destiny of humankind.
Well, it is, and particularly through the mainstream media. You know, if one cannot rely on the mainstream press, then any kind of fake news that's being put out by the mainstream press has got to be brought into question. Anyway, look, what I want to get to the point here really is, how does this link up with groups like ISIS, which seem to be a bit on the wane now in Syria, but certainly there is a very definite ideological bent to them? I mean, does that fit in with the Quran at all?
Well, not in the Quran, no. Quran doesn't mention ISIS, but certainly the Black Flag movements are mentioned in several of the prophetic traditions, which are considered to be authentic, that in end times there will be two groups who will raise the black flag. And as you know, in Afghanistan, the Taliban has got the black flag, and now you've got ISIS. ISIS, by the way, I believe, and I said it on television when it rose up, is a NATO Zionist creation. Sure, there are Muslims involved in it, but they've been funded, armed, trained by NATO, America, and its allies in the region.
Now, look, have you got any evidence? Have you got any evidence for that ISIS is actually being funded or created by the Zionists in Israel and NATO?
Well, I've not got chapter and verse, but one isn't naive to the schemes and plots of those who are enemies of Islam. The bottom line of ISIS is it has demonized, has given a great practical evidence globally in a global village to everyone that Islam is a bloodthirsty, fanatical, this, that, other religion, and terrorist. We give it also the terrorist stamp. So, I mean, do you honestly believe that is being inspired by authentic, divine, based love and justice values?
Well, and also, you've pointed out as well that may be being supported by NATO and the Zionists. So, of course, they're not really terrorists, because a terrorist is someone that doesn't have any official kind of state backing and support. They're a kind of autonomous guys that get hold of guns and try and do a revolution of some kind, whereas it seems that there certainly may be some support for ISIS amongst NATO and from Israel.
Oh, of course. I mean, the Yinan plan is to divide, balkanize the region. ISIS, the Sykes-Picot agreement, this is the 100th anniversary this year. I mean, divide and rule's nothing new. That model's collapsed. So they want to further balkanize the region, and this will strengthen the hand of Israel and the axis of evil, Tel Aviv, Rome, London, Washington.
Now, Donald Trump has said that he supports the idea of moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now, what significance might that have in Islam or for Muslims?
Well, huge issue. I mean, as you know, in our conference, we were going to raise this issue of Jerusalem, but we'll need another special conference on it. It's a very sensitive issue for many, many people. The bottom line is we're in interesting times. The status of Jerusalem is in question. The Americans or Pax Americana to date hasn't dared of moving the Israeli capital to Jerusalem. This bloke and his gang of right-wing neocon Zionist lovers are talking about that. This is a very dangerous move. And in eschatological terms, Jerusalem has a critical, pivotal role in global peace and justice. We have to watch developments in this city and this area very, very carefully.
Well, don't forget, of course, that many people don't know this, but the Chinese government, who, of course, China is a major nuclear weapons power. It's at the Security Council of the United Nations alongside the United States and Russia as one of the kingpins of the global military system. And the Chinese have said that they want to see a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. Could that happen, do you think, if Israel's capital moves to Jerusalem?
Well, as you know, the problem with Israel is it's had the backing. Well, it's a creation, an illegitimate creation of the so-called New World Order or Old World Order. And it's had carte blanche, you know, support by the superpower of the day. But obviously, power politics changes from, for instance, a unipolar world just now to a multipolar, which we're going back to. So, yes, Israel might be in for a surprise. And also from Islamic history, even during the Crusades, which I've been looking at carefully again, and indeed even Al Jazeera have, they have come up with documentaries looking at Arab perspectives on the Crusades. It's quite clear even during the Crusade periods, the Muslims had hudna, truces, with the enemy. During the Crusades, almost 1,000 years ago, 900 years, well, it was a 200-year war, there were periods when the Muslims and the Crusaders, engaged in truces. So in the contemporary situation of Palestine, there's the opportunity in diplomatic terms to have a peace treaty with the enemy. That is perfectly legitimate in Islamic law.
Yeah, and your point is what?
Well, some sort of peace treaty, could be formulated with the Zionist regime. I'm not advocating it, but I'm just saying even in Islamic history, in a similar situation, almost 1,000 years ago, the Muslims engaged in peace treaties with the Crusaders who were occupying Jerusalem or parts of Palestine.
چون سید به دام تو به هر لحظه شکارم ای طرف نگارم از دوری سیاد دگر تا نیارم رفت از قرارم چون آهوی گم گشته به هر گوشه دوانم تا دام در آغوش نگیرم نگرانم از ناوک مژگان شد و صد تیر پرانی بر دل بنشانی چون پرتو خورشید اگر رو بکشانی وای از شب تارم در بند و گرفتار بر آن سلسله مویم از دیده ره خوی تو با عشق شویم با حال نزارم با حال نظار موسیقی سخن راز گشایی خوش جلوه نمایی ای بردم آن از دل عشاق کجایی تا سجده گذارم تا سجده گذارم گر بوی تو را باد به منزل برساند جانم برهاند ور نز وجودم اثری هیچ نماند جز گرد و غبارم جز گرد و غبارم
One of the things we're not getting today is historical analysis on the region. I can remember when Radio 5 first started broadcasting its 24-hour rolling news back in 1990, I think it was, at the time of the first Gulf War. We had loads of BBC correspondents on. Every sort of 10 minutes, there'd be another one talking about the first Gulf War, you know, the Iraq, the surrounding of Iraq, moving British and American troops over to Saudi Arabia, for example, for that war, where Saddam Hussein was kicked out of Kuwait, but they didn't kind of carry on into Iraq. At that time, there was an incredible wealth of historical analysis from the BBC, from all their different correspondents. Nowadays, we seem to be getting very little of it. So I wonder if you could just elaborate a bit on the Sykes-Picot Agreement, because I know that that was signed in secret by the British and the French foreign secretaries at the time, 100 years ago, and it's one of the things which has led to the situation we have today. So can you just take us through Sykes-Picot and explain why we should be interested in that agreement, the secret agreement, which only came out after the Russian Revolution, because the Russian revolutionaries revealed it to the world. It was a secret pact with the French and the British.
Well, that's a very valid point. Well, several empires were destroyed by the First World War, so that raises questions who benefited and who actually instigated it. Indeed, every problem in the Middle East or Greater Middle East has arisen since the collapse of the Ottoman state. And ironically, under the cover of NATO, Turkey is a part of NATO, it's a legacy of the Ottoman Empire, is beginning to have a re-establish its sphere of influence in that entire region, as history seems to be catching up with us. But basically, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, depends when you take the starting point or finishing point. Some people say it's from 1924, but that was the abolition of the caliphate and the establishment of the Turkish secular republican state. Anyway, in 1917, when Turkey was losing the war because of treachery by its Arab Muslim citizens, if you want to call it, because they were misled by the imperialists who were saying revolt against the Turks, we'll give you independence. Did they help? That's why I mentioned the illegitimacy of the Zionist state of Israel. The Arabs were Muslims were made to fight each other. The Arabs were promised by the British and French revolt against the Ottoman Empire, and we will deliver you an Arab homeland. What, especially for the Palestinians in particular, which is really a part of the Sykes-Picot bigger picture or bigger plot. Basically, you know, the present they were given was a Nakba. The Nakba is the Arabic for ethnic, well, huge crisis, which is basically ethnic cleansing. That is their definition of it's a catastrophe. And a catastrophe, in one word, is an ongoing process of ethnic cleansing. And I think under ISIS, the old Sykes-Picot agreement is crumbling. I think they're trying to re-Balkanize the region.
So what are your thoughts about the progress of things in Syria? Because it looks as if there's now peace agreements being negotiated between the main parties, that is to say the Kurds, the Turks, and the Syrian Arab Army and the Russians.
Well, can anyone make sense of what's going on there? Great tragedy. Syria, in Islamic eschatology, this whole region which was partitioned by Sykes-Picot, you know, what is called Israel, Jordan, Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, parts of it in Turkey. All this was called Sham. Sham, or Greater Syria, has a huge eschatological role which will be played, and is being played out right now. Right now, I mean, the whole thing's a mess. Will it last? No, I don't think it will last, because any quid pro quo which is based on sand, really, building a castle on sand, will not last. You know, if dictatorship remains, if justice and the people's sovereignty and will isn't respected, it will not last. I don't see it lasting.
Now, you're talking about eschatology. This is really what the Quran is going to predict for the end of the world. Do you think it's really come to that?
No, I didn't say eschatology means end of the world. It is, the Arabic term is, means the end times, to use the English word, yeah? Or in English, eschatology means study of eschaton, the end. So the study of end times doesn't mean the end, the last day. Indeed, that's a separate phenomenon in Islamic theology, and indeed Judeo-Christian Islamic theology, the Day of Judgment. I'm not talking about the Day of Judgment. I'm talking about the phase of human history in which we are moving towards the end. And it has a very optimist picture, actually, in Judeo-Christian Islamic theology, where justice will reign, not just love. I remember at that conference, a minister talking about love, 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 love. I'm sorry. I'm not. People aren't just interested in love. They want justice. And the only way in Islamic eschatology we believe justice in this mad, crazy, sad, bad world will happen is the intervention, not of God directly, but of a divinely guided and blessed human leader who will be allied to the second coming of Isa, Jesus, who will be a follower of the Mahdi. So there will be a Christian-Muslim alliance by definition.
Now, some people say that they think the second coming of Jesus, when Jesus comes back, he'll be a Muslim. Is that true?
No, we've got a clear picture on what has been described in Islamic eschatology. Jesus has there's a whole chapter on Mary, Surah Maryam, in the Quran. You know, the virgin birth and all the rest of it, and the Abrahamic, tradition, of which Jesus is highly respected, equivalent to Muhammad as a prophet of God. Virgin birth, miracles, the book that's come, you know, the Bible. The bottom line is Muslims believe he was betrayed. He was about to be crucified, but he was saved. He's living. And he's coming down again in the land of Sham, Greater Syria, specifically Damascus. And him and the Mahdi will be allied. Whether he is a Muslim, yes. If you mean by Muslim, he's going to be a follower of God, yes. In that sense, he will be a Muslim and he will be allied and a follower of the Mahdi. He will pray behind the Mahdi in the Great Mosque of Damascus. This is clearly mentioned. It's not a figment of my imagination. And there will be a clash. It's not as simple as that. There will be a clash between good and evil, militarily and theologically.
Fascinating. I mean, do you think there's any real evidence that these prophecies in the Quran are really playing out today?
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, I think you mentioned about this interview. I do not think you can do justice to the rise of Zionism, which happened before the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. 1897 was well before the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in Sykes-Picot in 1916-17. So I think the whole rise of Zionism and then the First World War and the Second World War, I mean, this whole phenomenon, what the hell is Zionism? Yeah? I mean, that's another program. I think it can only be looked in the context of eschatology, in which the state of Israel and the forces and ideology behind it position its center stage in world history. There's a coming climax. It's happening already. Those who are blind can't see it. You need to look at developments in that region from a different perspective to understand what is happening and what is going to happen.
But
we're talking
hang on,
about Israel being at the center of a new world order. We're talking about a new world order government centred potentially in Jerusalem.
Well, look, the Quran is saying all sorts of things, and it's difficult for Christians to know really what people from the Christian, more Christian countries. But don't you think that there's some kind of correlation between what Christianity is saying and what Islam's saying? Because also worth pointing out that most Zionists in the world are Christian Zionists. They're not Jewish Zionists.
Well, that's a very good point, according to one Islamic expert, in particular, Sheikh Imran Hussein, based in Trinidad. If you Google him, Sheikh Imran Hussein, many videos. He also talks about this issue in eschatology, that in end times, how do we come to terms with this strange alliance? To understand this, obviously, the state of Israel, it is not center stage yet. You know, power isn't in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. Is in places like, you know, Washington, London, Rome, dare I say. Like the collapse of the British Empire, Pax Americana will also collapse. And maybe what's going to happen under Trump will have to be, maybe he's a Manchurian candidate, we'll see. But whatever Trump really is, the bottom line is Pax Americana will drain. And then the question arises, who will take over?
And who do you think will?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. To understand the Zionist state of Israel, have we all, as intellectuals, do we really understand what the state represents? Is it, for instance, a homeland for Jews? Or is it being manipulated by the pyramid satanic system to be center stage of the world for satanic forces and a coming clash between good and evil?
Well, it's certainly in the right place to do that, isn't it? Being sort of right next to the plains of Armageddon or wherever it is. Anyway, look, yes. How can people follow your work, Moheen? Because I think that there are a lot of people who are interested in all this, particularly the minutiae of Islam, because there seems to be a lot of fakery around, and it's quite nice to sort of pick that apart. So how do we follow your work?
Well, very good question. We've had a website up for 10 years. It's getting hacked, I might as well tell you. I think we're going to redo it and also maybe have a video focus. The last event, the Eschatology in the 21st Century Conference, Interfaith and Comparative Perspectives, is being constructed into a DVD. So we hope to put that onto the internet, including one of your websites. You know?
Okay, and whereabouts? What's your think tank, and where can we find it? If you've got a blog or anything, if people are interested in finding you online.
Well, this was on the think tank, but as I said, there has been some hacking. It's globalvision2000.com.
Okay, what about this imam? Maybe you can give us his name again, and we'll put a link into some of his videos.
Well, Global Vision works on a collaborative basis. Certainly, I'll give you his name. If you Google him, you'll get hundreds of videos. His name is Sheikh, Sheikh, Imran, Imran, Hussein, Hosein. You'll see dozens of videos. Some of them are on one of your websites too. By the way, I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but a lot of what he says needs to be, you know, looked at critically and with an open mind.
Okay, Moheen Yassin, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Yeah, and thank you for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, last year he lost his job as a professor at a Florida university. His name's James Tracy, and he runs something called the Memory Hole blog.
Until January of 2016, I was an associate professor with tenure at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. And I had a personal blog that I had been running since 2012. And I had begun to look into some of the anomalies and inconsistencies in the reportage on the Sandy Hook events of December 14th of 2012, and talking about them on my blog and attempting to elicit a discussion with readers on the blog about that, sharing information. And so it was kind of a, you know, collective intelligence operation, if you will. And we were delving into that event, as well as the Boston Marathon bombing and other rather unusual events as far as the reportage and so forth went.
Okay, many of those events have been used as an excuse to sort of clamp down on the possession of firearms in the United States. At least that's the way that they've been spun. But can you remind us what happened at Sandy Hook and what was wrong, did you think, with the reporting of it?
Well, we are told that 20 children in kindergarten, first grade, as well as six educators, teachers, and school administrators were killed by a single assailant. It was 21-year-old Adam Lanza. And that this was the rationale to really heighten restrictions on firearms in the United States. And there were a number of problems with that storyline, including the likelihood, the strong probability that Adam Lanza really could not have carried out that event, at least by himself.
Okay, can you give us any evidence that you've got that it wasn't possible for him to have actually done what we were told he'd done?
Well, certainly with the limited degree of physical wherewithal, him personally, I mean, he was 120, 130 pounds. It was likely not possible for him to be able to carry that degree of ammunition and those armaments into the school, carry out the event. We have virtually no video footage of the event actually taking place, even though there was a security camera that was a security system that was installed in the school in the fall of 2012. There is, of course, also the ubiquity of personal media, people with iPhones and things of the like. None of that data is available for us to, you know, to analyze. So there are a number of things, you know, I could go down a list, and we've documented a good deal of this as well, not only myself but other researchers, about the inconsistencies of the event. There's abandonment of medical protocol for treating the wounded and the dead. The fact that there was no external triage. The deceased were allowed to stay in the school for 16 hours or more, according to the official story. That's generally unheard of. It's not clear as to who pronounced them dead. There is a very high ratio of deaths versus injuries, which is unusual for events like this, mass shootings.
There's also the matter of Adam Lanza's father, who I understand was actually quite a senior banker of some sort, which wasn't reported at all at the time.
Right, and what's really unusual about that is that Peter Lanza, other, you know, fairly prominent individuals that figure centrally in the story, like H. Wayne Carver, Connecticut's foremost medical examiner, the state medical examiner. These people have not appeared in any interviews, televisual interviews, since the event took place over 4 years ago. Now, Peter Lanza, interestingly, did submit to, we are told anyway, an interview with an individual that was published in the New Yorker magazine, but nothing on camera. And you would think that these people would be forthcoming in interviews.
Now, your blog is called The Memory Hole Blog, which I think is a great title because quite a lot of things from history, important stories. I've had this myself, getting legal letters from individuals saying you must remove this from the internet, blah, blah, otherwise we're going to sue you. Of course, I try and do my best to make sure that those articles and interviews stay there because there is this ability to go to the courts if you've got money and to actually get bits of history erased rather than in a George Orwell like fashion. But can you just give us an idea from your point of view, what is the purpose of distorting and twisting the interpretation of incidents like Sandy Hook?
Well, I think so that the public and the media, both the alternative and mainstream media, cannot actually provide an accurate rendering of what took place. And so we have something turn into a myth, absent the real information that we need to be able to understand the event. And that, you know, this is something that I also, delved into at university. I talked to students and, you know, future journalists and attempted to explain to them the significance of good reportage, of digging, of investigation, of getting the facts, because if we don't have those, it's very easy for a myth that is not true in many ways to take root in the public psyche and really influence the trajectory of history, the implementation, the forging and implementation of policy, government policy and things like that. And that, I think, is exactly what we saw with events like Sandy Hook. And also, in the UK and in Australia, we saw events like the Dunblane massacre and the Port Arthur massacre influence policymaking in very similar ways that was attempted with Sandy Hook in the US.
Now, look, gun control is a bit of an emotive issue here in Britain because we don't really have a routinely armed police force here. And many think that the idea of anyone having a gun in the United States is somehow dangerous and crazy. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. I think that the individuals that are permitted, that are licensed to possess firearms, are the most law-abiding in that they have actually gone through law enforcement's checks, and they're the ones that are responsible. When you restrict gun ownership, as is the case in places like Chicago, you have illegal, ownership, possession, and this contributes to the wave of crime that we've seen, and murders, injuries due to firearms that have taken place there and in other locales that have, really strict gun control.
Now, is the restriction in Chicago, I mean, I'm imagining a kind of Al Capone scenario here, that Chicago's had a particular problem with organized crime there. Is that why there's a restriction there and not in other parts of the U.S.?
Well, there are restrictions in some other cities as well in the Northeast, and it is a mixed bag to some degree. But you find that to kind of reiterate, most individuals that do actually apply to legally own firearms are ultimately quite law-abiding, and yet these are the individuals that are being kind of clamped down upon. They're not the ones that are out committing crimes. They're seeking to protect their homes or to use them for sport or what have you.
Now, the idea of anyone having a gun, it sort of seems to be appropriate for maybe for the Wild West, but not for today, surely.
How do you mean?
Well, in all these old Western films, you see people shooting guns, everyone's got a gun, it's the normal thing to have. Certainly the British attitude, mostly, is that, that things shouldn't be like that, and it's actually not good, because you've got quite an astronomical rate of murder, homicide, you seem to kind of think you call it, in the United States.
I would respond that this is something that's part of our Constitution, of course, the right to bear arms. And one of the reasons that the Second Amendment is there and ensconced in the Constitution is to be a check against tyrannical government. you know, the experience in the United States versus Britain or the continent, there's so many disparities historically and politically with regard to, you know, the sentiment towards firearms. And I think that would involve really quite an interesting conversation because you really have to go back at least a couple of centuries to delve into that more so. But you're right. There is a different regard towards firearms in the United States, and you have a significantly vocal political element in the U.S. that does seek to guard the constitutional right to bear arms.
Do you think it's maybe more possible to have a tyrannical government in America than it is somewhere in Europe? Because, I mean, we do have in Europe pretty much a restriction on guns. You know, it's very much less common for people to own guns here. And I think some people would point to it and say, well, look, you know, Europe is a lot safer as a result.
Perhaps to a certain degree it is, but again, you know, most of the people who are actually committing crimes are doing so with firearms that are not registered, that are illegally purchased or obtained in some way, shape, or form. They're not the individuals who have them, safely secured in their homes or using them for sport or domestic protection or what have you.
Now, James, I know you're running a campaign to get reinstated in your job as a professor. I certainly wish you luck with that. Can you just tell our listeners whereabouts they can find your campaign and find out more about the legal campaign for you to get your job back?
Yeah, it's tracylegaldefense.org, and we are presently in court, and we have a civil lawsuit against the university and as well as against the faculty union that we argue abetted in my termination. And you can find out more and actually read the entire complaint at tracylegaldefense.org and also donate if you see fit. We certainly appreciate that. But, you know, this is something, Tony, that is, it involves much more so than me in my situation, because the university was seeking to clamp down. Actually, all the universities in the state of Florida can potentially clamp down on faculty members by getting them to sign an outside activities form. They have to submit and sign an outside activities form, and that can conceivably be used as prior restraint against a faculty member's speech. And so this is something that is it's a fight that's being waged on behalf of all the faculty in Florida and really throughout the United States, because, as you know, prior restraint is something that is forbidden by the First Amendment here in the U.S.
Good. Well, I mean, it's not good that it's happening. Thanks for telling us it is, because I think many journalists are in a similar sort of situation where, certainly when they're staff journalists rather than freelance, they're in a situation where they've signed contracts where, say, Rupert Murdoch, whoever it is, the BBC, own everything they say inside and outside of the, and everything they write, even if they write a postcard to their grandmother. So I think that the idea that universities or big media organizations should be taking ownership of what professors or journalists say outside the workplace seems pretty shocking. Anyway, just remind us of your website again for your legal fight, James.
Yeah, it's tracylegaldefense.org, and then my other site, memoryholeblog.com, is still up and available online. It's presently in hiatus. It's something that we're working on revamping, but all of the articles are still up and available.
Well, I hope it stays there. Thanks very much for joining us, James.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Moeen Yassin from the Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000. Also to James Tracy from the Memory Hole blog. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or finally through the National Volunteering website, where you can volunteer for all sorts of things. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is Radio Freedom.
KLF is gonna rock you. City.
KLF is gonna rock you. We'll be right back. for now.